few weeks ago, we drew out a short question. Questions regarding the crucifixion. And the crucifixion accounts in all four Gospels. And we'll look at some of the things in those accounts. And the question related to the various scriptures that we find concerning the crucifixion. Among those questions that come about, what does that mean, is there one Gospel that's more accurate than any of the others? Why do they not include some of the same things but read differently at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus? And another one that comes about from the Gospel of John, who was the beloved disciple? I can give you the short answer on that. We really don't know for sure. Everything is speculation. Church doctrine and church history speculates that it was John the Apostle who, if he were the author of the Gospel, would not have wanted to call special attention to himself by name, but just said the beloved disciple, and talks about the beloved one sitting to Jesus' right at the Last Supper. In recent years, there have been some scholars who have contended that perhaps it might have been James, the brother of Jesus, who was one of the one of his followers, and who, if he were indeed Jesus' brother, would obviously be beloved. But we really don't know for 100% sure who that apostle, that was the beloved apostle, is. But church tradition says that it was the apostle John, who was standing there at the foot of the cross. And that's about as close as we can get on that one. But the question that also spins off of that is, John is the only gospel to mention that conversation. It shows emotions of love and care and humanity in Jesus, so that Jesus understands our emotions, etc. But why would it not be recorded by other gospel writers, especially Matthew, who, you know, if Matthew was indeed one of the apostles, and Mark, who Peter would relate that to, except we have to remember Peter wasn't present at the foot of the cross. So if Peter got that story, it would simply be secondhand, and if this beloved disciple really didn't want to call attention to himself, he probably would not have spread all that around too much, etc. So, but that's as close as we can get on that question. His tradition says it was John, but we really don't know for sure. Now, when we look at some of the other accounts, the soldiers mocked Jesus, and then he begins carrying the cross member to the place of crucifixion. And it would have been the cross beam, not the entire cross. That cross beam would have weighed around 125 pounds or so. It would have been strapped across his shoulders as he carried it out to the place of crucifixion. But on the way, we find that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all mention Simon the Cyrenian. As they went, in Matthew 27, 32 and following, as they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene named Simon. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they offered him, that is Jesus, they didn't offer it to Simon, but you know, it almost reads like they could have. But they offer him, that is Jesus, wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his clothes among themselves by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." When we look at the end of Mark's Gospel, where we find in chapter 15, after Jesus has been mocked, starting in verse 21, they compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Then they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots to decide what each should take. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. Mark tells us it's 9 a.m. When that happens. Matthew doesn't. In Luke, with the crucifixion,
I guess the question there would be, you said that because it says the third hour and the start coming from 6 a.m.?
Yes. starts from 6 a.m. and the third hour of the day is 9 a.m. and the sixth hour of the day is noon. The ninth hour is 3 in the afternoon. So yes, that's where that comes from. And in Luke chapter 23, starting in verse 26, as they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming from the country. And they laid the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A great number of the people followed him, and among them were women who were beating their breasts and wailing to him. Jesus speaks to them. And then he gets to the place of crucifixion. And we move from, it doesn't say Golgotha, but we move from him carrying the cross and speaking to the women, Simon carrying the cross and Jesus speaking to the women, to the two criminals who were beside him. John only says Jesus carried the cross. So John doesn't include Simon the Cyrenian in all of that event. Luke, each of the gospel writers has his own particular audience and his own particular way of viewing the life and the teachings of Jesus. And what for not only him, but what for his audience are the important things to record to show them that God is indeed acting and present in Jesus of Nazareth. We could look at throughout the Gospel of Matthew. And tradition tells us that Matthew, or Levi, was Jewish and is writing predominantly for Jewish readers and Jewish Christian readers to convince them that Jesus is indeed the royal Messiah, spoken of in Old Testament prophecy, and the one that they should follow rather than Moses. Among the things that we find in the Gospels that indicate that are allusions to the Old Testament and Old Testament prophecy, especially in the birth stories concerning Jesus. We find that the numbers 3 and 7 are extremely important in the Gospel of Matthew, which are two key numeric devices in Hebrew theology and Hebrew numerology. A lot of things occur in series of 3 or in series of 7. 3 being a number of the sign of the presence of God, and 7 indicating wholeness and completeness. We find that the most important Christological title, that is, title that speaks of Jesus as Christ in the Gospel of Matthew, though he uses a variety of titles, the one that is most important, or seems to be most important, is when he calls Jesus Son of David, which links him with that lineage that Jewish folks were looking for Messiah, the line of David. And Jesus even, in Matthew's Gospel, there's a wide range of folks who recognize Jesus as Son of David and call him that, including children, blind men. He's coming along the road and the blind men, physically blind, call out to him and say, "Have mercy on us, O Son of David." And of course, his take is, here the blind recognize Jesus because they see with spiritual eyes, and the religious leaders look with physical eyes and don't recognize him. But that lineage, so, and there are several other things in there. Even in the birth narratives, the use of the Magi, which we call kings, royalty, and the inclusion of Herod in all of that with the Magi, and Herod's interaction with this royalty. Kings and royalty were very impressive for Jewish folks. And so the use of that, the use of signs, especially around the crucifixion, earthquakes, tombs being opened and the dead walking around, the splitting of the veil in front of the Holy of Holies that was the separating curtain between the Holy of Holies and the temple and the worshipers. Then only the high priest could go in there once a year when the presence of God was there. All of these kinds of things, and the earthquake at the resurrection that where the angel comes down, and the use of angels, and specifically calling them angels, in the Gospel of Matthew, indicate something of the author's background as well as the people to whom he's writing, to try and show them this is indeed the one you need to be following. It's the Messiah we've been waiting for. Mark, on the other hand, may have been an eyewitness to some things, but not until late in Jesus' earthly ministry, if indeed the Last Supper is held at the house in which John Mark grew up, and some tradition says that. And if indeed the strange statement in the Gospel of Mark in the Garden of Gethsemane, when the disciples decide to run, all of a sudden there's this one strange sentence in there, is that the guards tried to grab a young man that had followed along, but he left his clothes. In other words, he was wearing his tearaway jersey that night, and when they grabbed hold of him and tried to tackle him, he ran right out of it and took off running naked. And that's the only gospel that has that statement or any indication that there might have been such a person there. So some scholars and historians suggest that perhaps that was Mark's way of saying, I may not have seen it all, but I was there at this point. But Mark is writing his gospel during the time that Christians are being persecuted in Nero's Rome. And it's much more fast-paced, and there's a lot of persecution and a lot of tension between Jesus and the religious leaders and the Romans and all of that kind of thing. And there are other things that indicate that Mark was probably written during that time, and to Christians who are being persecuted. And so he's got that particular audience in mind when he is writing. Luke, tradition says Luke was what? A physician and a Gentile. A Gentile physician, learned, very educated man. Interestingly enough, Luke, out of the resurrection accounts and the birth narrative, Luke, who is a physician, who you would think if anybody was going to doubt a virginal conception, it would be a physician, writes a much more glowing account than does even Matthew. And in the resurrection account, yeah, right. The physician says, yeah, right. This guy's raised from the dead after 3 days. No. But he writes a very convincing account. He's convinced of it. But Luke is writing for a wide range of folks, but he's writing predominantly for Gentiles to show them, A, that Jesus is indeed not just one of the pagan deities, but Jesus is indeed God's Messiah. That Jesus came for all people, the learned as well as the poor and the outcast, and one of the downtrodden groups in Jesus' day, women. In Jesus' ministry, in Luke's gospel, Jesus is constantly uplifting women to an equal place with men as God's children. Luke is also, quite frankly, Luke writes both the gospel and the book of Acts, 2-volume work, with some references in it that indicate he's trying to show Gentiles, and in particular the Roman government, that Christianity is not a politically subversive religion. But the kingdom Jesus talks about, he's not trying to overthrow the Roman kingdom down here on earth. It's another kingdom. And that Christians, indeed, are not seeking to overthrow the government, but are trying to live and treat people fairly and equally, and the kingdom they speak of is the kingdom of God. And so when you look at these different target audiences and the backgrounds of the particular writers, and you look at things that they include in each of their gospels which the others don't, much of which points toward the people they're writing to, giving their understanding. It would, Carrie, it'd be like you decide to write something about the gospel and about Jesus, and because of your position with GE, you decide that there are folks that really need to understand how important Jesus is as Son of God, and so you write it in a way that folks who may not be church folks, but that understand as co-workers in GE, and you'd include things in there, or maybe word it or arrange it so that they say, oh, I can relate to that. I can understand it. Well, that's kind of what they were doing here.
But that's poignantly And I guess I was the one that submitted the question. That's what got me about Luke. Being a physician, you would think that that would really be the one that would tie even more to the conversation with Mary, more than John would have. I mean, because then that really goes more to the, I guess, the healing, you know, from a spiritual and physical standpoint, and showing that connection.
Yeah.
And had those two said that, I could see a little bit more of that. Yeah. I guess I'll pass it on. Luke left that out.
Well, I think, you know, and you might think, okay, Luke is looking at that, but Jesus is dying at that point. He's trying to make provision for his mother. And so by doing that, the beloved disciple supposedly is the author as well. And so, you know, he kind of says that to that particular person to take care of his mom, etc. I also think there's more to it than that. I think he's also trying to remind Mary when he says, "Behold your son, here I am, this is what I came for." I see your point with Luke, but Luke does a great deal of research, and he does, early in his gospel, he's the one that says, you know, that the shepherds come, common people, they come and they tell Mary and Joseph and the others present, probably midwife, what they've seen and heard, and they went rejoicing, but Mary kept these things in her heart. Luke does research, and he says right up front, knowing that a lot of people have tried to write this kind of stuff, having checked it out thoroughly. So, you know, I understand your question there, that why wouldn't it be Luke at that point with Jesus including it. But Luke, once again, is a Gentile convert from years, maybe even decades afterwards, when he's writing it and has done this research. And even in talking with Mary, she may not have even mentioned to him that. You have to look, too, at the time frame. Mark is the first one probably written during the mid-60s to about 70. Matthew and Luke are writing somewhere around 75 to 85. The Gospel of John is not, in written form, is not dated until about 85 to 90. So it's after as well. So, you know, we don't know how much information he got and from whom. And when you look at the Gospel of John, it's pretty evident in many ways. While there is history in all of these, there's also preaching in all of these Gospels. And they're called the evangelists. And euangelion is good news, and an evangelist is somebody that tells the good news. John obviously knows of the existence of these other Gospels, and they agree a lot in chronology and other things. John writing much later, and with the advent of Gnosticism, where knowledge is the ultimate good and self-knowledge is the ultimate kind of knowledge, and groups of Gnostic Christians, especially a large group in Alexandria, Egypt, who believed that Jesus was a spirit man that came not to die, and those Gnostic Christians taught that Jesus didn't die because he was spirit. And flesh can't kill spirit, but he came to lead people into self-knowledge so that they would find that they and Jesus are twins and just alike, and therefore they're like God. So you see, New Age stuff is just old age repackaged. Then, you know, that's late in the first century. And John, much of what he writes, while there is history within it, at the same time, he attempts to give kind of a theological spin or understanding. This is what God is doing in this. Therefore, in the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, Luke, you've got one of the pivotal events, the cleansing of the temple, beginning of the last week of Jesus' earthly ministry, and they say, hey, we got to have this guy killed. In the Gospel of John, it's at the beginning of the ministry to show that there was always going to be tension between Jesus and the religious leaders throughout his ministry. You've got Matthew, Mark, and Luke having the crucifixion on Friday, Good Friday, 9 o'clock in the morning. Jesus dies around 3 in the afternoon. You got the writer of the Gospel of John placing it on Thursday of that week, the day of Passover, at noon, when the first of the Passover lambs was being slaughtered. When do I think historically it probably happened? Friday morning. Why does John say that? Because John is saying, by placing it there, Jesus is the perfect sacrifice, makes all others obsolete. That's his theological understanding and what he's trying to tell folks, that in this historical person, God is present and acting for this reason. So I think when we read the Gospels and we look at all these different ways that they approach for how they have understood God in Christ, and then writing it to reach people who are like themselves or who will listen to them and show them how that works out, then that kind of, we understand that different people react to different things. If we were to all walk out front, we're standing there talking on the front steps, and there's an accident right out here, and police come to interview us, there would be as many variations on that accident as there are people that witnessed it. Some would have different descriptions, but the event still occurred, and we know it occurred, and some things would be similar, but there would be some differences. Why? Because of our perspectives. It's a moth. It's a similar kind of situation here. And they're trying to express their understanding of what God is doing. So they record what for them are the important steps toward the crucifixion. And they record what not only for them are the important elements to include for their understanding, but also for those to whom they're writing. Early on, they didn't write anything. There were a lot of folks who expected Jesus to return before Christians died, because they misunderstood that saying where he said, "Truly I say to you, some of you who are standing here will not taste of death before the Son of Man returns with power from on high." And they said, "Oh, well, that means when Jesus comes back, we'll still be alive." He meant, I think, something different by that, but they were thinking the literal second coming after his death. So for a long time, this is oral tradition. And then, because the older folks are dying out and Jesus hasn't come back, and there's a fear we're going to lose contact with the eyewitness accounts if we don't write something down, they start recording snippets of these things. The Gospels don't contain everything. They're episodic, and they don't contain everything Jesus said or did. And they certainly don't record every meal he ate, or every time he went to sleep, or got up, how early he got up, or how late he went to bed, that kind of stuff. So I think that with all of that in mind, that's why you get these variations in what is included about that important event, the crucifixion and resurrection. And as we've said before, that's one event with two parts. Without a resurrection, it's just another Jew that's been killed by the Romans. And without a crucifixion, you can't have a resurrection. So they all talk about Simon carrying the cross. John says Jesus carried the cross, but they all indicate Jesus carried it at least part of the way. And that's our understanding. But here we've got Simon the Cyrenian, this outsider, who is forced to help Jesus carry the cross, or in the Gospel of Luke, carries it for him. But which also says that in this event, Jesus is not just reaching out to Jews. Simon the Cyrenian was a Gentile. And so, you've got that. Matthew and Mark say the two criminals mocked Jesus. John simply says there are two criminals on either side. And Luke is the one that says one criminal mocked and the other one didn't. And the other one said, "We deserve to be here." Once again, I think because of, in part, and by no means am I downplaying at all God's hand in this and inspiration. I think there's some inspiration, but God allowed the writers who understood that truth to pick some of the words that, because they're human words, that mean something to them, etc. But God inspired what was, what they did. I think once again you've got these two criminals. Hey, if you break the law, you deserve it. Forget anything. And here you've got one who defends Jesus, and for whom Jesus says, "I'm going to tell you, from this day you're going to be with me in paradise." Because of that act, which is seen as an act of contrition, though he doesn't say to Jesus, "I'm sorry," the understanding of Luke is that this outcast was redeemed by Jesus when he defended him, and by defending him, he is being contrite. Therefore, any of the outcast, sick, diseased, poor, women, anyone who is outcast, even the learned, might consider themselves the educated outcasts with such a simple message. Anyone can be redeemed by Christ. And it does show the compassion of Christ. Why all the Gospels didn't include it? Once again, part of it is a matter of what's important for those writers personally in understanding and telling the story, and also their readership. But I mean, I'll ask you this question, and I'm not picking on Carrie, but I can ask one of y'all. Think back to an important event in your childhood, and how you remember and what you remember important about that event. And have you ever told it and had a sibling to say, "Well, no, that's not how it happened"? Or, "Now, wait a minute, you're forgetting, yeah, Mom got on to you, but she got on to me worse. You only got to switch once, but I was the oldest and I got it three times." But you didn't remember that, you know. Or, you know, "You're the one that got us in trouble to begin with." "Yeah, but you were older, you were supposed to know better." You know, and memory, sometimes we are selective in what we remember. And if you're talking about Matthew, if this is indeed Matthew who was the disciple and who authors the gospel, and Jesus dies in A.D. 30 and the gospel is not written until 75 or 80, that's a long time before it's penned. And so what he remembers and includes are those things that most vividly stand out for him, that show who Jesus is as Messiah and show the importance of crucifixion and resurrection. Luke is going on other people's accounts. Mark is going on perhaps what he saw, if he was indeed present there toward the end, but also the remembrance of Peter. John Mark was considered the scribe of Simon Peter. And much of what he writes are things that Peter remembered and passed along to him. Same thing with John. And if it's not written, of course, if it's the same guy, the disciple who wrote the gospel, and Jesus dies in A.D. 30, and presumably John was one of the younger disciples, probably late teens to early 20s at the most, and he lives and doesn't write until 90, he's an old, old man by then. And so once again, those things that most vividly stick out and show for him who Jesus really is are what he records. So it's not so much that there are, and I don't know if this is in part where you were going with this, is that in reading these accounts and they don't record all the same kinds of things, what's wrong here? But if we think about, once again, our telling of family stories, and the way what's important for us sticks out individually, yet together it fills out the whole picture.
Well, and I guess going with the last one, the thing that really shocked me about the other three Gospels not having the account of one of the men sitting there saying, "We deserve this, and we get what we want," is that shows the ultimate price that God paid, or Jesus paid, for everyone. That ever who confesses on Him is saved. And you would, that's really, if you're trying to convert someone, every one of these Gospels, to me, that's the most important thing that they could really show. And so,
is God's compassion in Christ.
Is why would that be left out? Because that's really, today you will be with me in paradise is probably the most important thing that they could have put in.
Well, once again, it's speculation, but only one disciple was present when all of those events happened. All the other disciples are recording either what they saw or what they have heard from people who were there. And Luke obviously has done more research than anybody else. And perhaps he's the only one that really picked that up. Or perhaps that, for the other gospel writers, that wasn't the focal point for them. Matthew and Mark, the only sayings they even record that Jesus had from the cross, were the strange saying. It was the strange, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," my God, why have you forsaken me?" That cry of dereliction, shortly before Jesus dies. Luke, on the other hand, is, you're talking about compassion. Luke is the one that records those kinds of things. It is Luke that records Jesus showing compassion on the folks killing him and the ones who got him there. Luke is the one that has Jesus beginning his time on the cross with a prayer, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing." And I think he was not, we often think, oh, he's talking about these guys killing him. Right? He's talking about them, but he's also talking about these other folks out here mocking him and the ones that put him in that position to begin with. Luke is also the one that, once again, I mean, the Romans, these folks that killed him, they're outcasts, and yet Jesus is showing compassion and asking for forgiveness. Two criminals, they deserve to be there. Jesus doesn't for anything he's done bad. One of them mocks him. Luke's the one that records it, the other one, and Jesus shows compassion and grace and redemption. Luke is also the one that has Jesus, though, at the end, ending his time on the cross with a prayer. "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." So, you know, those things with grace and compassion and the compassion of God, even for Jesus there at the end, are what are really key to, I mean, who is Jesus in comparison with the religious establishment and the Romans? He's an outcast. Which is another reason that Luke, I mean, in the Gospel of Luke especially, you find Jesus. You find him some in Matthew with Levi, the tax collectors, and other sinners. But especially in Luke, you find Jesus constantly with those folks who are marginalized and outcast and showing that compassion. And here you've got an educated physician who is a Gentile, who himself from Judaism is an outcast, but who also understands what it's like to, for example, own slaves. Because whether he does or not, he's got friends that do. And he sees how sometimes they're marginalized and pushed off to the side. And how women are treated as second class at best. And how they're marginalized. And from what he understands from the eyewitnesses that he's interviewed, and the things he's put together, and the things that he's read and weeded through, for him, that's the key, is that compassion for the outcast. For Mark, the key is, we're in Nero's Rome. You're being persecuted. Jesus was persecuted. Jesus went all the way to the death. What are you going to do? Are you going to deny? Or are you going to stand up even to the death? And his is very much more fast-paced, the shortest of the Gospels, and leaves you with that question. What are you going to do? The women go away at the end and they're afraid and don't tell anybody, according to Mark, chapter 16, verse 8. Obviously, they told somebody, but once again, are you going to tell people in the middle of persecution or not? Are you going to keep quiet and twiddle your thumbs and go sit in the corner and act like a wallflower and hope nobody notices you? No, I don't want to dance. Go ahead. Or Matthew, who is so, the author of Matthew is so concerned with the conversion of Jews to Christianity because they're still following the law of Moses. And when Jesus, just give you an idea, when Jesus, in Matthew, every time Jesus preaches to the crowds, he's on a hillside or the top of a mountain. That's not unintentional. Because who went on a mountain in the Old Testament? Moses. To get the law and get the authority. Jesus is on the mountain and he gives the law and explains the law. Why? Because he has the authority. Therefore, don't follow the law of Moses. You need to follow Jesus. And when you've got magi, kings, royalty, coming searching for this baby and bowing down before him and giving him gifts and paying him homage, well, if he came for kings and they recognized him, then who are you to turn your back on him and follow the law of Moses? And then John, I mean, the writer of the Gospel of John at the end says, you know, these things have been written, and many more could have been written. Why? What does he say? That you may, anybody? Believe that Jesus is the Messiah. He says, I'm writing this stuff to you to prove to you he was the Messiah and to interpret all of these events that have happened. So, I don't know if that really answers your question or not, or just confuses the issue even more, but when you've got all of these different gospel writers who do have a target audience, and that target audience is folks who are like themselves, actually, Because they have become convinced and they have come to know the truth and they're wanting to share that with someone else, then it really shouldn't be that big a surprise that this one includes this, but this one doesn't, but he includes this, which this one doesn't, and some of them cross cultural lines and religious lines. It's just like you mentioned the crucifixion accounts. We see these differences, and yet in these, there is still that truth that Jesus was crucified and that he died at that particular in that month, in that particular year in history. When you turn to the resurrection accounts, it's a similar ballgame. About the only things that the four Gospels agree on in the resurrection accounts is that Jesus was raised from the dead and Mary Magdalene was among the folks there. And the tomb was empty. Because they give different lists of the women who were there. Once again, what's important? I mean, you've got, in addition to Mary Magdalene, you've got several of Jesus' relatives. You've got Mary, the mother of Jesus, and some of her cousins who are there as well. Well, Matthew, Judaism, the importance of family and family sticking together. And you've got in Mark, you've got the women running away after they see a man in glowing clothing. Matthew calls them angels. Luke says that there are men in glowing robes. In John, Jesus is misunderstood and not recognized, thinking he's the gardener by Mary Magdalene. Once again, though, they are looking at it from their particular perspective for the folks that they're trying to show this is the truth about Jesus of Nazareth and he is Messiah. Because that's what convinced them too. So I think that what meaning we can take away from that is that the gospel messages in these four gospels, what we find not just in the crucifixion and the resurrection, but even in some of the teachings through Jesus' life and the way he relates to other folks, is broad spectrum, not narrowly focused. But it's a broad spectrum. And so the meaning is that it's available for Jews who are like Matthew and people who feel persecuted and frantic in their lives, like the folks that Mark was writing to in Nero's Rome being persecuted, to the educated and the marginalized that Luke writes for. And John says, and here's how you tie it all together and understand it all. This is what God was doing in Jesus through these events. And the fact that they are different, I think, and especially in the crucifixion and resurrection accounts, you know, there's some folks that say, oh, that's just preaching. Well, but the fact that they do continue in the same vein in which they were written, I think, speaks more to the validity of their understanding of, you know, and of that event with both parts than if all of a sudden you read all these different things that they include in the parables and other things, and then you get to the end and suddenly it's verbatim right down the line in every one of them. Because they would not be true to themselves if they started copying somebody else instead of what convinced them and what was important for them and how they get the message out. So, is that good? Anywhere around? Yes? Yeah, the question is, what about Torah and the prophets? The Jews had that, and yes, while there was foretelling, what's really a couple of things are bound up in their misunderstanding. One is the idea that God would never lower himself to become human. Yes, but the way they took that, though, and the suffering servant and all that kind of stuff, was that the nation of Israel was actually the suffering servant of God. Now, in the intertestamental period, some of the non-canonical writings in the pseudepigrapha start looking at Messiah as an earthly figure and Son of Man as a heavenly figure. They did have those writings. Well, some of them, yes, and some of them, no. And many of the rabbis didn't like folks reading the stuff that was in the pseudepigrapha because it was wild and strange and that kind of stuff. Yeah, he said he did. Yeah. Well, yeah, the disciples understood something was different, but they didn't fully understand it after the crucifixion and resurrection. The other folks were so caught up in the idea of Messiah, because he reads that passage out of the prophets and says, today in your hearing the scriptures are fulfilled, and they get mad and want to kill him. Why? Because he's blaspheming, saying that God would come in a human. And for them, Messiah was an earthly political king. Messiah means the Lord's anointed or the anointed one, and ever since Saul was anointed as the first king, that was their short-sightedness. That's what are we familiar with? We're familiar with an earthly ruler who is the adoptive son of God and rules on behalf of God. The king wasn't just... there was not a... early on, there was not a separation of civic function and religious function. The religious leaders kind of ran things, and even with Samuel, that happened early on. He's the one who not only decided religious matters, but civil matters. When the people clamor for a king, and Samuel really didn't want them to have a king, but God said, no, I'm going to give them a king. At that point, the two get separated out, where the king is to be over the civil authority, and the priest or the prophet is over the religious authority, but the king still gets his authority from the priest, which happened later in the Christian church too as it developed, in Europe especially. But the king got his authority from the priest, and what really got Saul in trouble with Samuel and with God was when Saul started taking over when he didn't want to wait for the priest, and he started taking over the priestly functions as well and doing sacrifices and all that kind of stuff. But from the very beginning, when Saul is anointed as king, it is so closely tied to an earthly political ruler that that's all they could see. And so even though some of the prophets spoke of this off in the future, they had blinders on. No, it's got to be this way, because when Isaiah in Isaiah 7 that's the sign of Emmanuel. In Isaiah 9, the messianic hymn, for to us a son is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders. The government shall be upon his shoulders. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of peace there shall be no end in his kingdom, upon the throne of David to rule and reign with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. And so, throne of David, earthly king. And so even though some of what Isaiah is really talking about is something beyond that earthly king, well, he talks about it for Hezekiah, but it's really speaking of something beyond. They couldn't see it for the blinders. And those passages were read every time there was a king crowned after that. And so it was so ingrained, Ariel, that it was so ingrained that the only way to understand the prophets and prophesying about Messiah was either Israel is a suffering servant as a nation corporately, or Messiah is an earthly king. But when Jesus comes to be much more than they ever imagined, even the disciples, what did they try and do? They took swords into the garden and used them to try and defend him. After the resurrection, crucifixion, resurrection, they begin to understand differently. But even on the mount, when Jesus is about to, in the book of Acts, is about to go into heaven, ascend into heaven, the disciples say, okay, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? They're still going back to that earlier thought instead of grasping the larger picture. Crucifixion is around AD 30, and first gospel of Mark, somewhere around 65. 60 to 65, so you're talking 30, 35 years later. Right, and process it. Yeah, process it and come to understand it even better over that period of time. Right. Right. And that's not. In fact, the early events that happened in the biblical text that aren't recorded, the earliest writings are just shortly before 1000 B.C. And if they happened, long before that. And Genesis chapters 2 through 11 are actually not written until between 1000 and 960 B.C. And if that's the account of creation with the man, then the animals, then the woman, then the fall, and Cain and Abel, and Noah, and Tower of Babel. And that happened thousands of years earlier, but it's not recorded until that point in time. So if you look in the overall perspective, much of what was recorded in the Old Testament, you're talking about hundreds to thousands of years later, and what's recorded in the New Testament is, you know, 30, 50, 70 years later. Yeah, so it's much closer to the event. Okay. If nothing else, then we will... Well, next Sunday is Mother's Day, so we won't have evening service, but the following Sunday we will. And though the children will be singing that morning, we will draw out another, what does this mean? And on Sunday night the 18th, we'll talk about that. As you go, know this. We are all different, the ways and our the ways we look at things, our perspectives are different. And different things mean more deeply or convince us more deeply than others. Why? Because we are persons. We're not one lockstep entity, but we are persons. And in that, we have different understandings that help us not only to gain some sense of what God was and is doing, but also to share that with other folks who, like us, need that perspective and our perceptions. So just as the gospel writers give us different perceptions on the truth of Christ's life, His crucifixion, and His resurrection, study hard, ask the questions, and share your perspectives for the good of the kingdom. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.